Joanne Folletta is in her 28th and final season with the Virginia Symphony. She's also spent 20 years with the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra. Ever since she was a little girl, she knew she wanted to be a conductor, and she says she's living the dream, and she's very happy about that. Her new recording with the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra is a live performance. You'll hear Brahms Concerto No. 2 and also highlights from Prokofiev's ballet Romeo and Juliet. It's this week's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Macher. I'm talking with conductor Joanne Folletta of the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra and also of the Virginia Symphony. And Joanne, you just opened your final season with the Virginia Symphony as you've made the decision to finally step down after 28 years?
28 years, yeah. And it's been a very happy tenure, lots of great music. And I learned so much from being with them for 28 years. You know, not only people always recognize how much conductors learn from musicians, even wordlessly or mostly wordlessly, and how they play and how they follow, how they can lead you. They can lead you to be a better conductor. And I'm very grateful to those musicians.
So how did that feel, though, when you stepped out on the stage knowing it would be your last opening season concert with them?
It was actually a beautiful last opening weekend, you know, very filled with love and filled with thanks and, you know, a little bittersweet. But I've had such a good tenure there and such a good relationship with the musicians and the community. I just love the community. So it seemed like now they're about to be 100 years old, and I thought that is the perfect time for them to find new leadership as they go into their second century. So it just seemed like that was the marker. And I'm still doing a couple of concerts this year, but it felt like a summation of something and something happy, you know. Like I feel like I don't have any regrets there. I mean, we've done so many wonderful pieces and big projects, and to be with those musicians around me for one more opening night, it felt very good.
Can you think of one example of what you've learned from them?
Well, you know, a lot of times someone might ask a question, a string player might ask a question of the subtext of which, are you sure you want to do that? But ask it in a way that's so much more graceful. Like, it seems as if we should make a retort here. Do you mean that? So whatever, just the way they pose questions. Or their comfort level. You know, if they're playing in a way that they seem free and they seem unconstrained and they're playing with emotion and they're playing naturally, organically, then you know you're doing something right. If that doesn't work, it's something you need to change. So a lot of it is wordless and learning pieces, learning so many pieces for the first time there. That's been a great thing. So a very happy time.
You're also getting ready to launch your 20th season with the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra. How are you feeling about that?
Very good. I think that Buffalo's come a long way in the 20 years that we've been together, and the orchestra's changed a lot. You know, a lot of retirements have happened over those years, and a lot of very young people have come into the orchestra. So it's been exciting for me to help build that and to take what was a very beloved orchestra in its city and give it a little bit more of a national and international presence through our recordings, because in these 20 years we've been making a lot of recordings that strengthened us enormously as an orchestra.
So what keeps you in Buffalo?
You know, Buffalo is a city that suffers maybe from a little bit of sort of self-esteem problems, because people always laugh about us about our weather. Now, I'm going on record as saying Buffalo actually does not have bad weather. It actually is most of the time really beautiful. Gets a little snow, but a lot of places get some snow. The city is wonderful. The people are wonderful. And the orchestra has a pedigree that's impeccable, with music directors like William Steinberg, Joseph Cripps, Michael Tilson Thomas, amazing people, Semyon Bischkov. It's just astonishing, legendary conductors. And it's a very beautiful orchestra that plays in a very fine hall. So we're hoping to continue to get better and stronger and more flexible all the time.
How do you view your role as the music director and conductor?
Well, my role really is to establish a situation, to create a landscape where excellence can flourish, where these extraordinary musicians can be the way they are, can be free, can be individual, can be independent in a way, can be the musicians inside them. And that's happening. You know, they've developed a fantastic personality. I mean, they're really a very exuberant, very charismatic, very characterful group of musicians. And that, of course, with the audience is a beautiful thing to see. I mean, they are playing for their audience and their audience is loving it. So that kind of connection between a city and its orchestra, I don't think is that common. And I feel very privileged to be in the middle of that.
So, Joanne, think back to when you started falling in love with music, and how did you come to the realization that you wanted to become a professional musician?
Well, I started as a 7-year-old. Actually, on my 7th birthday, my father gave me a classical guitar, and he had arranged for a lesson the next day. So I started my journey then, and I loved it. I loved everything about that guitar. I loved my lessons. And I had a wonderful European teacher who also taught me harmony and theory and ear training. And so I think from around the age of 7 and 3 months, I was hooked on music. I was a musician, and that's how I thought about myself. But it wasn't until, let's say, 10 or 11, when I was starting to go to more orchestra concerts with my parents, that I discovered the orchestra, this amazing body of talent, this amazing team on the stage, and the repertoire that they played. And I was overwhelmed. I was overwhelmed by their commitment, their passion, their connection to each other, their dedication to excellence, and then what they produce, the pieces I heard of Beethoven's Six, I mean, that I will always remember, spoke to me in a way that nothing had ever spoken to me before. And I said to my parents, I want to do that. And they said, well, we don't really know what that person does, and nor did I. But I knew that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be the person that helped that happen, that made it possible for those musicians to be the great musicians I could hear. So it started very early, and I've never looked back, and I feel like I'm living my dream now, and I'm very happy about that.
And that guitar still plays an important role in your life, in one way through the International Guitar Concerto Competition, which you founded. And is that every other year, every few years?
That is every other year, and it's specifically for concertos, guitar concertos, which is a relatively rare approach to a competition. But we in Buffalo, we get 10 finalists from all over the world, as far away as Thailand and all over South America, Europe, Japan, China. It's quite amazing how the guitar has spread everywhere, and the level of playing is really high. So it's great for us to welcome these young, talented soloists to Buffalo, and many of them are coming to the United States for their first visit ever. So I'm glad that it's happening in Buffalo, and I still play guitar. For me, it's a nice foil for the publicness of being a conductor, where you're constantly with a large group and you're doing things constantly and talking to people and making decisions. With a guitar, you can be sitting in your room very quietly and working on just the exact sound of a note or a connection, or it's just beautiful. So it fills a need for that sort of quietness that I love.
And the first prize is a wonderful cash prize, but also a chance to perform with the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra a second time, it sounds like, right?
That's right. That's right. The 3 finalists do perform on that night, on that competition night, which is amazing. I mean, the electricity in the hall is amazing. But they do come back then and play a different concerto with us. And I love accompanying guitar because I know the repertoire, and I know, in a sense, how to support the guitar in a way that makes it shine, lets it shine, and lets it showcase all of its beautiful nuances and color. So it's a great treat for me to do that.
Well, your 20th season with the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra has some exciting guest artists coming up. I love the story of how Leonard Slatkin got on the program. Would you share that?
It's so wonderful. You know, Leonard and I have known each other for a long time, but he contacted me about a year ago, I guess, maybe a little more than that. And he said, you know, Joanne, I've long ago when I was really, you know, just starting my career, I came to Buffalo. And I'll never forget the joy of an orchestra believing in me at a young age and inviting me. And it was an orchestra that had a great, great history. And I'd like to come back. I'd like to sort of say hello again and say thank you in a way. And I said, well, Leonard, you know, we're an orchestra that's a lot smaller in our terms of our budget than orchestras that you usually work with. And he said, that doesn't matter. This is a sort of a life tour to visit the places that I've loved in my past. And I thought that was so beautiful. So he is coming, and I'm just thrilled about that.
And you also have Danny Elfman's violin concerto coming up. And I was curious, who's your soloist going to be for that?
Sandy Cameron, violinist. She is extraordinary. And she's the young woman for whom he wrote the concerto. Now, Danny Elfman is an amazing composer, but most people think more of Batman and The Simpsons when they think of his name, and not classical music or concert stage music. But this is a new departure in his life. It's a new adventure for him. And he, knowing Sandy, and he met her actually in Cirque du Soleil, where she was amazingly an acrobat violinist. She would sort of climb up a rope and play violin from the ceiling or something like that. But she is amazing virtuoso. And he had the idea of trying to write something for her. And he wrote an absolutely brilliant four-movement violin concerto, very profound, darkly romantic in a way. I've been telling people who've wondered what it's like. I said, well, you have to sort of imagine, what would it sound like if Batman played the violin? And they're very intrigued by that. But it does have that sort of city noir feeling to it in a beautiful way. And she is one of the greatest virtuosos I've ever worked with. So I'm thrilled.
Joanne, your latest recording with the Buffalo Philharmonic was made during your Florida tour earlier this year. Why do you do that? Why do you tour Florida?
Well, it's very important for us to stay in touch with the many Buffalonians who are in Florida in the wintertime, the snowbirds, we call them. They are among our biggest fans, our biggest lovers of classical music, and we like to stay connected with them. We like to visit them. So we've been going to Florida every other year, touring on both the West and the East Coast, many different cities, and we always try to bring together a CD of the repertoire that we play on our own label, on our Beaufleurve label, as a sort of special present for them. But it's become to a document of where we are at that moment, you know, in our history as an orchestra. What are we sounding like in March of 2019? Where are we? Where have we gotten to? So it's, for me, a very, very special record of the way we are developing as a musical ensemble and the character of the orchestra at that time.
So there are two major works on this recording. How did you pair these works together on this program?
Well, the Brahms Concerto No. 2 was a specific request by my dear friend Fabio Bedini. Fabio Bedini and I have been working together for a couple of decades, I think, and he's one of my favorite pianists, a dramatic virtuoso who also is a very profound soul. And he said to me, you know, Joan, we've done everything. We've done Rachmaninoff, we've done Beethoven, we've done Franz Liszt, et cetera, et cetera. But we have never done Brahms. And once, I want to do Brahms 2 with you. And Brahms 2, for me, is one of the most profound pieces ever written, because it's not only, you know, Brahms, of course, who's an amazing composer in every way, but it's something about his life. In it, you can hear his love for Clara Schumann in the slow movement. He uses a song that he wrote for her. And the words, I'm paraphrasing this, but the words are something that's so tender. He said, "In dreams I hear you calling for me outside my door, but I cannot get up and open it. I wake and weep bitterly." Kind of a sense of missed opportunity or a love that wasn't to be or something that went past him somehow. And when I told the musicians in the Buffalo Philharmonic that poem, and there was quiet for a minute, and then the viola said to me, "How can we play now?" After thinking of Brahms and that love of Clara Schumann, and that's that beautiful cello solo that you hear in the Andante. It's a great moment for the cello. It's a great moment. And knowing what the text of the song is really colors it with a kind of melancholy. You have to play it in that way. You can't play it in a way that it's too overwhelming or bravura. Instead, there's a kind of tender regret in it. But that's very beautiful, too. And we've played it a number of times, and he played it with Fabio alone, and the sense of connection that they had to each other really made it work. And it is one of the greatest moments of that piece. But, of course, there's beautiful solos for oboe. And the clarinet section also, in that third movement, the slow movement, has beautiful, again, a Brahms song that they play in the upper register, very soft, accompanying the piano. The title of that song is Waiting for Death. So not a happy song, but a very, very tender, floating, beautiful moment.
The horn also has an opportunity to shine. In fact, right at the very beginning of the work.
That's right. And this is, you know, the horn for all of the German composers, I think, has a soul. It's almost the soul of German music. And it's nobility. It's morality, it's goodness, it's purity. The horn means all these things. And with Brahms, that's exactly what he's saying. He opens it up with a horn as if to say, this is something noble. And it is. It's so noble and human at the same time.
This work, this Piano Concerto No. 2 by Brahms, really stretches the boundaries so much that it's almost more of a symphony. So if that is kind of the case, what role then does the piano play?
You know, for Brahms, all of these concertos are symphonies. I think he thinks of them completely symphonically. And that's the great tension and drama on the stage, because you have two protagonists. It's not about the piano the way it might be about the violin in a Paganini concerto, where it's all about the violin, or the piano in a Chopin concerto, where it's really all about the piano. But not with Brahms. Oh, no, it's the piano and the orchestra as equal forces. And they're sort of flexing their muscles, both of them. It's not an immediate melding of souls. But that tension, those two mighty protagonists on the stage, is what gives the piece its majesty. Brahms heavily invests in the orchestra. I mean, some of his greatest playing is for the orchestra, and that makes the piece, just as you said, a symphonic concerto. And the Allegretto, when he comes to the sense of Hungarian music, kind of a reflection of his lifelong love of Hungarian music, his friendship with Josef Joachim, and the sense of, well, life goes on. It's a very interesting story about how he discovered this music. You know, Brahms grew up in Hamburg and in a very poor family, so probably on the wrong side of the tracks or whatever, in a poor place. And when he was a teenager, there was an edict that was sent out that the Romani people were expelled from the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. They were expelled. So they had to get out or be imprisoned, and they fled to the ports, and many of them went overseas, the United States or South America. But Hamburg was one of those destinations, and so they were flooded into Hamburg to get on a ship and get out with no money. So what did they do? They made music in the streets to raise some money. And Brahms, wandering down these poor streets and, you know, in these poor neighborhoods, listening to this music, listening to these people play, formed a lifelong love of this music. It just got into his heart, got into his soul. Later, when he met his great friend Josef Joachim, who was Hungarian, they explored even more fully this kind of Hungarian music. And it's in there. I mean, it's in many of his pieces, but the Allegretto movement is a kind of sort of tearful smile, I would say. A smile with a tear, because it's as if he's lost Clara Schumann and he's turned away from that in his life, but he goes on. And he sort of picks himself up and, with a touch of melancholy, plays a Hungarian gypsy melody. And we take whatever joy we can. And for me, it's always been kind of a heartbreaking piece. And so the idea of doing it with Fabio, who felt a very similar way, was wonderful. We did that 7 times in a row, and I've never gotten a reaction to that piece from all of those audiences ever before. I mean, there's something about Fabio's total connection to it, and because of his total connection, the orchestra's connection to him.
So tell me, when you said you hadn't seen that kind of response before, can you describe that a little more for me, please?
Well, it was at the end of the last movement, which sometimes can end in a way that doesn't inspire a great round of enthusiasm. In a sense, Brahms gets smaller as he gets to the end of the piece. He starts out with a bigger orchestra, and he sort of takes away people towards the end. It's very intimate. He gets more intimate as he goes on. But in this case, all 7 times, the audience reaction was electrifying. They were on their feet. They wouldn't stop clapping. And it was as if they knew that something special had happened, that Fabio had given them something special, maybe not to be put in words, maybe not to even be able to explain, but it was quite overwhelming. And I guess it's his total connection and belief in the piece, my love of the piece, and the orchestra's love of the piece. And you can feel that love.
Thank you. The other piece on this recording is Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet, selections from the three suites that he extracted from the original ballet, and then you have extracted what you felt might make the best suite from those. How did you do that? What was your criteria as you were putting together your choices from those three suites?
Well, everyone has their favorites, and some of them, you know, everyone agrees upon. You know, you have to have the Death of Tybalt, for instance, and the Montagues and the Capulets. But I wanted to put together a collection, and I think there are nine movements, that's kind of followed the storyline, so that someone who knew the story of Romeo and Juliet could go through those shifts in mood, could live through the story without words, but could imagine what was happening. So that's how I placed them. And since the Brahms was so symphonic, I thought maybe this program is not the best place to do a symphony. The Brahms is really a symphony with a mighty pianist in it. So doing a ballet suite seemed to me a nice balance to that. It wasn't a four-movement symphony. It was the kind of ballet where the mood changes dramatically from one movement to the next.
So of the movements you selected, do you have a favorite you'd like to talk about?
Well, I guess we have to mention the Montagues and the Capulets. This sets the stage. I mean, the arrogance of these two families and their posturing. I mean, they're in the marketplace and they're intentionally snubbing each other, you know, like not looking at the other because this enmity has gone on for generations, I guess. But their pompousness and their arrogance is a kind of key that nothing is going to be an easy ending in this, because it's starting from this place of unease. So we know, we get a dark feeling right from that. We know that this is something that is going to perhaps end in tragedy, and of course it does. The Romeo at the Grave of Juliet ends the selections, and this I always think of the original choreography, which, you know, has Romeo realizing that Juliet is dead, or imagining that Juliet is dead because she's taken this potion, and he dances holding her in his arms. Now imagine the strength of the Russian ballet dancers to be able to do that, to be able to carry what is a dead body, with incredible tenderness, dancing in grief. I always think of that at the end of that, and there's something overwhelming about the power of that movement.
That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, the latest from Joanne Folletta and the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra. Special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. If you're enjoying New Classical Tracks, the best thing you can do for the show is to tell somebody else about it, help spread the word, and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. I'm Julie Amacher.